Mares.
Woo!
Here we are again.
Oh, the YLT time machine.
Well, we're in London, and I think we're in the 60s.
The 60s? Which 60s? All right, Jen.
Hey, Mares.
Hey, this time travel, you know, it's starting to get a little easier. It's not messing with my system like those first few time travels.
Yeah, I don't have as much vertigo.
Right.
You know,
right.
I kind of, my equilibrium is a little better now.
Thank goodness for that. I mean, because maybe it has something to do with like what 60s you go to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe the 1960s a little easier. And then those 1060s last time, wow.
Yeah.
They're pretty rough.
Yeah, they were rough. You know, they weren't quite as groovy as those 1960s.
Right.
I'll
so
say that.
I repeat my question. Which 60s? Where are we going?
You know, I'm going to get there, Mares. You just kind of take a look around at the landscape for a second.
Okay. Mystery 60s.
We're going to get there because... I have a few questions for you first. And actually, earlier this week, I texted you
a few questions. Remembering.
And I asked you if you'd be keen to answer them. And of course you were. You're Mares. You're always keen for that kind of stuff. I love it. So for our audience, and I have it here. You don't have to look it up.
Okay,
I've got you covered.
All right.
I've got you covered. So what I asked you was, when people in the present, so in the 21st century, and we're thinking... you know, people in Western Europe and North America. And I'm saying that because that's just our realm of familiarity.
Sure.
So I don't want to speak for others. But when people in those general areas, like I said, and we're talking generally, complain about the woes of the modern world,
mm-hmm.
what in general do they gripe about? Or to look at it another way, what was better about the, quote, good old days?
Right.
I wanted you to try and think broadly rather than personally and consider multiple perspectives to think about what people from opposite sides of the aisle, for instance, might say.
Right.
So basically, I wanted to know, what do the masses consider the ills of our society? And you responded with, in case you don't remember, you said, my gut goes to what I seem to read and hear a lot. Say, quote, people are disconnected. Looking at a screen instead of each other. Or people are more apathetic to others around them. They're in it for themselves. Okay? I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
I followed up with asking you a few more questions because I like to make you work.
Sure. Yeah.
And I said, great. What about the news and current events? You know, what are the headline stories, general controversies that seem to dominate contemporary thinking as far as problems and issues go? And you said sensationalism, that headlines are leading to and resulting from increasingly partisan politics, that sensationalism means having to produce on a constant basis, that there's less research, riskier points of view. And of course, this leads to someone listening to one little item out of context and then repeating it. You also said that you feel there's a general anxiety of a constant, quote, message coupled with the misinformation resulting from the sensationalism above.
Right. I think I was thinking about, you know, those general things that people do talk about, like apathy or anxiety. And those are not necessarily measurable, but something called a 24-hour news cycle is measurable. It is something that has changed in the last less than 50 years. And so that might be a route that you could point to that is connected to some of those other issues.
Absolutely. And thank you for answering those questions.
Sure.
Your answers were fascinating to me. And now you're probably wondering, as you look around this landscape and you're thinking about those
still
questions,
wondering, yes,
why I'm asking you for contemporary hot takes while simultaneously inviting you into the YLT time machine.
Yeah.
Because the time machine goes to the 60s of various centuries, and we are in the 60s. So what am I doing? Where are we going? Why are we going here? We are, in fact, going back in time to the 60s, and we are in the 1660s.
Okay.
So why on earth did I ask you all those questions? Well, Mares, let me tell you. The 1660s, obviously, obviously differ greatly from 2023 in many ways. And we're going to explore those differences for sure. However, despite those differences, what I've discovered is that there are actually many themes of life in the 17th century that overlap with a lot of themes in our contemporary society.
Oh, man. Okay, I am intrigued now. I'm with you.
It's kind of shocking, okay. Isn't it? I mean, that was the thing I just kept coming back to. You know, as we dig deeply into a plethora of a topic, any topic, sure. And that is definitely including this one, the more I'm in awe of the realization that not only are there many themes, trials, and celebrations of the human experience that know no geographic border, that there's things that are universal. There's also cross-cultural commonalities, if you will, amongst different regions and sub-regions of the world. But those same conclusions can also be drawn when looking at humanity over time.
Ooh.
Which is fascinating to me. So I think it's easy to think that we share nothing in common with the people of the 1660s. But I'm here to argue that saying that would deny us an opportunity to see some hidden connections that can provide us with education and insight into our current world.
I mean, is anything better than being able to transfer the lessons that maybe were learned, you know, then to our current day, like just that transferable information and application?
Well, and I would pose to you, you know, do we even have a responsibility to do that? Does it honor the suffering of the past?
Right.
To do that.
Because I'm no expert on the 1660s, but I do know in London, Jen, my gut take was like, if we thought COVID was bad, like they must have really felt like they were living in the end times. I wonder, did they?
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the end times because, yes, we are going to talk about that. And many did think that they were living in the end times. And obviously, to be clear, just as a disclaimer, differences definitely exist,
yes,
obviously.
Yes.
And we need to respect those differences. It's kind of like how I'm not a fan of the whole melting pot concept
right. When
it comes to cultures. I'm not going to say, oh, look, we're all one across the centuries, because we aren't. You know, we need to recognize, respect, and celebrate commonalities and differences from both a cross-cultural perspective and in respect to the continuum of time,
yeah,
I think. So are you ready to look at the 1660s and explore these similarities and differences?
Ready for some stories, ready for some connections,
I've got some. Really? And, you know, I brought a cocktail today to the studio. We haven't had it yet. We're going to have it after the break. But you said, would you like to have a cocktail before? And I said yes, and you're going to find out quickly why it's needed. We're going to be talking about some heady things.
Oh, boy.
It is. The 1660s are, wow, I really can't imagine living through this time period. I just want to start with sort of painting a picture of 1660s London.
Please.
Okay. I found a quote by someone named Nick Renison, and he says, quote, "The Londoners of the 1660s had to face crises unmatched in the city's history until the Second World War. They struggled to survive in a dangerous world, one in which life was cheap and death could be just around the corner. But they did so with energy and capacity for enjoyment, for which the inhabitants of this great city have always been known."
Okay, I've learned something already. That's fantastic. I picture just suffering. So that's so fascinating already.
And there is a lot of suffering, but entertainment was a huge part of the 1660s. Yeah. There were the traditional fairs and festivals, things that we think about. Theater was really coming into its
1660s.
Own. Absolutely. Yeah. There was also bear baiting. Have we talked about bear baiting in a previous episode at all?
I don't know if we have or not. You might as well bring it up.
And bull baiting.
Yeah.
It's
right along,
you know,
Southwark, right? I mean, I think
yes.
They're right along the river. There were
And they had arenas and they would subdue these animals and then tease them, essentially.
Yeah. Kind of like cockfighting, too,
yes,
and all that stuff that's going on.
It's dodgy.
Man.
I mean, it's
1660s
dodgy.
Entertainment. Ouch.
Yeah. Gambling was also huge. And again, that kind of happened on the outskirts of things, behind closed doors. But there was also a lot of new forms of music, a lot of early prototypes to instruments that would be familiar to us today, starting to really evolve. Public performance of music, dance was really taking off and was very important. There was a huge interest in fashion, particularly continental fashion, continental Europe. There became this love in England of the buckled shoes. There was, in men's fashion, the precursor to what would be the three-piece suit was really taking off during this time.
The waistcoat.
Oh, yes. And periwigs were taking off at that point. It's also a time when the royal parks and the shopping arcades were coming about, and tennis and horse racing, two sports still really associated with England, were really taking root in English society as well. Basically, people were out and about like never before. And that's because previously, meandering was always purposeful, either for work or worship. The idea of meandering to socialize and for leisure was something that was completely new. And I had never really thought about that, but that was just how it was. Now, the city itself looked very different from the city we know. And it was a pretty treacherous place. There was some crime. But this is really sort of before, and we've talked about this in a few of our other episodes that have come up, like I think in some of our ghost episodes and things about the street pirates and robbers and things like that. There's some of that, but it's really before that peaks at this place. But the dangers were more just from this meandering. The way the city was built, the buildings were all made of wood.
Yes.
They were extremely close together.
Right.
And they would start at the ground, and then as people needed more room, they would build on top. But the buildings would jetty, so the second floor would be out wider towards the street than the first.
Okay.
Then the third floor would come out wider and up until basically the buildings almost formed a closed dome over the street.
Wow.
So as a result, the streets were extremely dark.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very crowded and very densely populated.
Right. I can picture that in my mind now, certain medieval villages still that kind of have that shambles look of where, you know, that architecture coming together.
Yes. And the thing I kept running into everywhere was how dark it was because of the way the building slanted, natural light didn't really get through. Now, on top of that, when people are walking, there were fights in the streets. And the fights occurred over your walking position. And that was because everyone wanted to be walking as close to the buildings as possible.
Okay.
There was a reason for this, Maris.
And?
As I said, these buildings jetty out. So, you know, the upper floors are hanging out more towards the middle of the roads. We also know this is before Bazalgette and his sewers.
Yes.
People had pots that needed to be empty.
Their chamber pots, yeah.
And the sewers of London at that time were the streets, and general practice was it would be thrown from the upper windows into the road. So fights would ensue because people didn't want to walk in the middle of the road.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
And have human waste hitting you, which was a regular occurrence. Yeah. Plus, the waste that's already out, that's what's all in the middle of the road.
Sure.
So fist fights were a common occurrence as people battled for their positioning. It's kind of like, you know, battling for your spot on the tube platform today. You want to, get a good carriage and get a seat or whatever. This was the jockeying for position of the 1660s. Similar to what we talked about in our Victorian era episodes, because of reasons that we just talked about, the city was full of all kinds of smells. There was the sulfurous smells of coal burning and fires. Obviously, the human waste. Hygiene standards were very different. Fresh water, extremely difficult to come by. Similar to the Victorians, the safest things to drink were beers, ciders, wine, tea or coffee, especially coffee was really surging at this time. There was a popular, this is when coffee houses really start.
1660s, wow.
And coffee houses became for white males a social hangout where intellectual conversation would occur. But yeah, there's a lot going on. Essentially, it's a bit of the olfactory nightmare, every bit of the olfactory nightmare, probably more than Victorian England was. The luckiest people could have a lead pipe installed and have fresh water or the freshest water available come to their home, which came was coming from a spring. I'm trying to remember from part of maybe from the Thames estuary. I can't remember.
Sure, sure.
But
rivulets that used to go through the sea.
And it's coming through a lead pipe.
There
so
we go.
There's that to consider as well. So yeah, so that's just kind of a picture. You know, we've got all the tradespeople, agriculture on the outside of the city. It's a pretty brutal society as far as crime and punishment. If you are caught stealing, death was often the result. If you were found guilty, public hangings were another popular form of entertainment as well. There's, you know, written record at this time is a lot different, but there's two people that really left behind great accounts of life at this time.
Okay.
The first was John Evelyn.
Hmm.
John Evelyn, I have to say it, he probably deserves an episode in the future.
Okay.
He was a royalist, and he was also a fierce conservationist.
Wow.
Absolutely fierce. And he was a prolific diarist.
Okay.
He was extremely dedicated to trees and fighting air pollution and was a prolific author. He penned many, many books on subjects as diverse as theology, humanistics, politics, horticulture, architecture, and vegetarianism.
Wow.
He was a jack of all trades. We're going to come back to Mr. Evelyn at times in this episode. And there was also the one who more people are probably familiar with.
Sure.
And that's Samuel Pepys.
Right.
And his famous diaries. You know, Evelyn was a little busier with all of his other many books that he wrote. Pepys, he primarily left his diaries behind. Right. You know, he didn't have the other writing career that Evelyn had. And as a result, he just wrote more. He basically journaled, and it was just so perfect for us, Samuel. He journaled from 1660 through the end of the decade. That was really
didn't
his...
Didn't he start on, I think, New Year's Day, 1660?
Yes, he did.
So, like...
Yes, and every New Year's Eve, he would write a year's summary. I did. I was familiar with Pepys. You know, I read English. I majored in English. So I was very familiar with Pepys. But I did learn a lot about him in general, and some things that I didn't remember about his diary as much. He wrote a lot of it in shorthand or code. But what's interesting is, despite that, it's very obvious that they were definitely intended to be read by the public. And that's because he left behind detailed instructions on how to translate his diaries. So why was the shorthand code? He needed somewhere to write about his mistress's
marriage. Okay, that's what I wondered. I'm like, is it the wife?
It's the wife. He had, Mr. Pepys had a wandering
Samuel.
Eye. He had a lot of dalliances, shall we say, and we don't want the missus to find out. So she was aware they had a tumultuous marriage. She was not stupid. But despite that, Samuel gives us insight into the daily life of an upper middle class white man, but he also gives us insight into the lives of his wife and his servant. So you get that little bit of diversity, and at least from his perspective anyway, of how things are going. He writes about everything, public life, work life, politics, happenings of the day, and like I said, his many personal activities, some of which are a little more seemly than others. So, like Mr. Evelyn, we will be coming back to Mr. Pepys throughout this episode of the podcast. So I want to introduce them at the beginning. So there are several components to 1660s England, things that made this decade, you could argue, one of the most challenging maybe in history for a particular area. The first part I want to talk about is war and upheaval.
Okay.
I really was not aware of how I knew individually about different wars. I had no idea how pervasive war was for the English and everybody else on the British Isle at this time. The people of the 17th century were just used to upheaval. There is no other way around it. Civil war had created chaos all throughout the preceding decades leading up to the 1660s. It had been incessant. I know we're focused on the 60s, but I am here going to give you some bare bones basic facts.
Thanks.
About the numerous wars. Yeah. Basically from about 1939 all the way through the 50s. And I'm
or
not
going to 16.
Oh, I'm sorry. I knew I was going to do that because the 6 looks like a, I
know, was
and the 9s, I even as I was writing this episode, I kept thinking, I knew you were going to have to correct me on that at some point. So do it again if I do. No, 1639 through the 1650s. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into huge detail because those years aren't our focus, but even just the basics are going to sound chaotic. And that's really my purpose here. Mm-hmm. I want to capture the chaos that I'm sure the average 17th century Londoner must have felt as they went into the 60s.
Yeah.
I think also about the lack, similar to what we were talking about earlier, when you mentioned the 24-hour news cycle that we live in today and how chaotic that can make things feel. On the flip side, I think about how the lack of news sources, print, digital, all the things we take for granted or are overwhelmed by, rightfully so, how that must have made them feel overwhelmed by the same token. Information basically came via word of mouth, and we know how problematic that can be from human to human.
Yes.
Or it came from the kings or Oliver Cromwell, depending on when, from their heralds. We're going to kind of look at that contrast of the chaos that undersaturation makes when we're very used to oversaturation in for many of us. So how did that little available communication impact them and what was all happening? So here we go. Here's a blitz of events from about 1639 on. So from 1639 to 1640, those were the Bishops' Wars.
Okay.
The Bishops' Wars were basically the English and the Scottish Royalists versus the Scottish Covenanters, which were basically hardcore Presbyterians. Mm-hmm. Okay. These battles primarily were in Scotland and Northern England and resulted in victory for the Covenanters. Okay. Mm. So that was to start out in the 1640s. We have a small break, then we move into 1642, and from 1642 to 1646, we have the first English Civil War.
Okay.
That was the Royalists versus the Scottish Covenanters and the Parliamentarians. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at like Cromwell and his people. The battles primarily occurred in England and Wales and resulted in victory for the Parliamentarians, but ended with Charles I, who was king, refusing to make concessions to the victors. Okay? So you have the Parliamentarians who want to overthrow the monarchy. They end up winning, but Charles is basically like, I don't care. I'm still the king. Peace didn't last long, as you can imagine. So then we move into February of 1648. And between February and August of 1648, the Second English Civil War starts occurring, mainly fought again in Wales and England. But here's where it starts to get confusing. This time, the Scottish Covenanters join the Royalists against the Parliamentarians.
Sure.
And there's a lot of this side jumping, which again, I go back to the lack of information for the general person to keep all of this straight.
Right.
And I had no idea that the Scots, different factions of Scots, jumped the line as much as they do in this time period.
Guessing like some, incentivized.
It was definitely, you always read my mind, and that was exactly it. I'm so happy you gave me that segue because, yes, Covenanters joined the Royalists because Charles surrendered to them after the First Civil War, rather than the Parliamentarians. That's how much he hated the Parliamentarians. Sure. And because he refused to make concessions to the parliamentarians, that came back to bite him. Basically, during the Second Civil War, his son, Charles II, who would be, you know, his successor to the throne, he went in exile to Scotland. And he actually became king in Scotland. So he's now the king of Scotland, which Scotland allowed because they were super mad that they weren't consulted about the beheading of Charles I.
So uniting against a common enemy, they're like, I may not be your team, like, but at least we're not Cromwell, right?
That was exactly it. That was exactly it. So as you can imagine, this was a tenuous break. And then we're into 1650 to 1652. And this is the third English Civil War. So we're on the third Civil War in about a decade. And this is Scotland versus Cromwell in England, because now Cromwell... So you have the royals, you have Charles in England, Scotland. So when Charles gets to Scotland, he's looking at what's going on in England. And he says, okay, we're going to really build up this Scottish military. And he does. This causes concern in the Cromwell camp. And England is, of course, invaded. And this starts shit up again immediately. The English ended up winning. And they said, we've had it. We're just going to absorb Scotland. We're done. You're part of us now. And Cromwell became the Lord Protector. In a strange twist, in fighting after Cromwell's death, Charles then becomes crowned King of England.
Right.
Because now Scotland is is there. So meanwhile, while all that's going on, three civil wars, you also have the Irish Confederate Wars that are going on. And that basically spans 11 years, from 1641 to 1653, which staged the Irish Catholic Confederates against various opponents over the span of those 11 years. So various opponents, the English Parliamentarians, the Scottish Covenanters, army from the Kingdom of Ireland, royalists, pro-treaty Irish Confederates.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And eventually the Commonwealth of England. That is then wrapped up with the brutal Cromwellian conquest of Ireland. And it all ended with the Irish Catholic Confederation dissolving. Meanwhile, while Ireland's going through famine and all sorts of disasters. And it was vicious. And in fact, Cromwell's legacy is still debated within England. And a lot of it is due to the viciousness, his viciousness in Ireland against the Catholic Confederates. And that finally all ended with the Act of the Settlement of Ireland in the early 50s. So, to summarize, historians calculate that some 15 to 20% of all adult males in England and Wales served in the military between 1639 and 1653.
Wow.
And 4% of the total population died from war-related causes.
Wow.
Just to put that in perspective, we know, because it's more contemporary, how deadly World War I was. 2.23% died in World War I.
Wow.
So this was almost double the death toll during this time.
Yeah.
So it those figures illustrate the impact of how much conflict there was.
Yes.
And not only that, the bitterness from the rivalries still hangs over the air as
and
we
now
move.
You have loss on top of it.
Loss.
So then it's personal. It's not political.
Exactly. It's political, it's personal, and it's a lot.
Ooh.
As all that's going on in the 50s, right when things settle down, like you said, there's the bitters, the grudges, all those kinds of things. The Anglo-Dutch Wars then start.
Who else wants a piece of me?
The Dutch. You would have thought the Dutch and the English would have been good friends. They were two Protestant nations within a largely Catholic continent. That was a bit of the problem. You know, you had the largely Calvinist Dutch and the Anglican English, and they were battling for trade routes to Asia. So right after all the Civil War carnage, the first Anglo-Dutch War starts in 1652, which pitted the Commonwealth of England, which is now Scotland and Ireland and England, versus the Dutch Republic. Long story short, it did end in an English victory of sorts with the Treaty of Westminster. So let's take a breath. That was everyday life on a political level, leading us into the 1660s. And the chaos...
I'm exhausted, Jen.
It's exhausting.
Just hearing about it.
It is. And it had the chaos and destruction had to have affected basically everyone in society.
Yeah.
I don't know that anyone would have been unaffected by all of this. It obviously affected different people in different ways. And yeah. Class absolutely played a part into it. But I think one could safely say that no one survived all that unscathed. It affected our friend John Evelyn.
Yeah. How's John doing?
John, in the early 1660s, looks at all the devastation of the previous two decades, and he penned Sylva, that is spelled S-Y-L-V-A. It's a publication, and it's Sylva, a discourse of forest trees.
Hmm.
Now, you might be wondering, what does this all have to do with civil war? Well, Evelyn saw the massive destruction that occurred as the result, or the massive deforestation that occurred as a result of all the destruction of the wars. And Sylva is his manifesto on the importance of green spaces and the need to replant trees. It was really also a seed of inspiration then for the Victorian landscape of gardening and plant mania. Mm-hmm. People went back to Sylva at that time. And I think one could also reasonably posit that it was a seed for the numerous green spaces that are central to our dear city today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was, if you're looking for somewhat of a silver lining,
right.
John Evelyn is kind of, he's that guy that's there for that collective good of London. So Londoners are entering the 1660s trying to breathe after decades of internal bloodshed and violence. They had a break those first couple of years. But if you remember, I said it was the first Anglo-Dutch War. With a name like that, you know there's more to come. The Second Dutch War reared its head in 1665, which pitted England with the help of Scotland and Munster, which is, Munster is an interesting area. It has to do with the Roman Empire settlement near like Bavaria.
It's
Germany today.
Okay.
That area. Munster kind of, I wasn't really familiar with it in that context, but yeah. They joined up with England against the newly restocked and revamped Dutch Navy, who was backed by Denmark, Norway, and of course, France. They wanted to join in. Both sides wanted to attempt to control the trade routes to Asia, especially as Spain and Portugal began to lose power. And both England and the Dutch, being Protestant countries, were anxious to get rid of Catholic Spain and such. They start to battle. There was also that little issue of the future prospects of William III of Orange, who was the posthumous son of the Dutch William II of Orange, and who also happened to be Charles's nephew. So we've got some lineage to the throne that there's a reason,
always.
You know, and the Dutch don't want the English to have this peace. And so you've got the royal issues there. William was designated a child of state in 1660.
What does that
England.
Mean? A child of state?
It implied that he was going to be trained for high office by the States General in England. When the Dutch sniffed this out, they weren't happy. And after his mother died in 1661, she had actually named Charles as the guardian of William. And this gave England a measure of influence in Dutch politics. The Dutch as a whole weren't fans of this. The English, on their part, they were not fans of Dutch prosperity. And from their viewpoint, the English viewpoint, the Dutch were making a really disconcerting economic recovery following the depression that had come in the wake of the first Anglo-Dutch War. And similar to World War II, England's economy was struggling to recover. And they were in an economic depression left over from the reign of Cromwell from, you know, since the first Dutch War. So all of this turmoil in the 1660s resulted in the Dutch seizure of English naval ships. And the English seizure. So they start fighting. Once they do that, then the English seizes the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam, presently New York.
Yeah.
And by 1665, they were at it full blown again. Again, the English Navy proved superior, but this time it was by a much smaller margin than it had been in the previous war. This one came to a break in 1667 when the Treaty of Breda was signed, which allowed the English to keep New Amsterdam, New Netherland, and Cape Coast Castle, which were all previously held by the Dutch. So that affects United States history. This war does. And in exchange, the navigation acts were adjusted so that the Dutch could then import to England using their own ships and not having to salute the British flag. And they were also allowed to retain Pulo Run, whatever that is. So in the end, after all of this fighting with the Dutch, you had 7,210 killed, 7,000 wounded, 2,000 captured, 29 more ships lost, and 2 warships captured. Utter exhaustion.
Yes.
But Mares, we're only beginning. War was just one sliver of the 1660s pie. I had a lot of details that I wanted to give because I wanted to illustrate how chaotic the political landscape was. It was overwhelming to sift through it. I can't imagine being a person living in there. There's more that's getting ready to come at them. And after we take a break, I want to talk to you about everything else that was coming towards these poor people.
I need a break. Honest to goodness.
Well, let's go make the cocktail I told you about.
Yeah.
Because we're going to need it.
Yeah.
These people need it.
Okay. Let's do it. Again, this is not only gorgeous to look at, it is delicious. And it's honestly unlike anything I think I've had before. Tell us what we're drinking.
Well, you are very astute because it would have been unlikely you've had it before. Okay. I haven't found it in North America. It is.
Yeah, I haven't seen it on the shelves over here.
You know, I had a little expedition to London this summer.
You did.
And they put suggestions about how many bottles that you should bring back.
Suggestions? Really?
Suggestions. but sometimes...
How many bottles did you smuggle in, Jen?
It might exceed single digits. It might be around 10 or 11.
So you taught me a new... verb, you know, that I had never heard of, a new term.
I don't think the English really care how much money you spend and take out.
That's true.
And I think North American airports, they're kind of like, whatever.
You know what? Enjoy.
Just go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
it's not customs, like you're not buying American booze, too.
Exactly. When I went through customs, the guy, you know, he took my claim form and he said, you know, and he just like, he goes, get out of here. And I said, really? Okay, good. I mean, it was fine. He didn't want details. I didn't give it to them. I had it all buried in my, I checked. I did carry on the way over, which was pretty good for 2 weeks, but I did check an empty bag. Yeah. And then dirty clothes were rolled up with things. So if any of our listeners are a part of
their accessories to your crime. You just told me a new word, which was, you're like, this is the first bottle. We're going to do the great unsmuggling.
Yes.
We're going to open up the first bottle.
This is the first bottle.
Tell us what the product name
is. It caught my eye because I really bitter aperitifs, like things like Campari and like Italian Amaro and things like that. You know, typically I'm a gin drinker, but when I do vary from gin, I either kind of go towards agave liquor, like tequila or mezcal, or I'll go towards Amaro. Mm-hmm. And this was an English aperitif, and it caught my eye. It is Acre, is how I believe it's pronounced, like acres of land, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's spelled A-K-E-R, and this is the English Rosé aperitif, and it's made with all English botanicals, with all English plants from the English countryside.
And it's super smooth, too. It's so not smooth. Really, I mean, I get hints of wine, but it's not a wine
oh,
for
no,
sure.
Oh, no, no, no. It's
and
definitely
fortified.
And there's
hints of botanicals, but it's not super medicinal. But it's smooth would be my adjective.
Yeah, it's like, it's definitely in the vermouth family. You know, it's said on the bottle, it's suggested to put a few sliced strawberries and mint sprigs with
did.
A cube of ice. And that's what we did.
And looking at it, it's kind of a grapefruit pink color, the actual liquid. It's just beautiful. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
As you said, we're going to have to fortify ourselves for round two of the 1660s.
On this one, it seemed like something maybe people in the Middle Ages would be
We're getting a little taste of the field,
and,
right?
The field and fen of
yes,
the 1660s. So, and believe me, they needed some. They needed things to help their ailments.
Right, right.
Because there were many. And it kind of leads us into the next part.
Okay, let's go.
1660s, ailments. What do you think of, Maris?
Well, I mean, we were just talking at the... Oh, well, there's the big one. We were just talking, though, of an already weakened, populace. Because you said there were 7,000 dead, and then I heard 7,000... wounded, and so
just
I'm thinking
the Dutch Wars.
Yeah, and so that's these people without a lot of medical support or support of any kind. So if you can't work, I'm just thinking of an already weakened populace in some ways.
Well, and with 7,000 plus that were killed in the Dutch Wars, you have to assume of those wounded, there was many who died pretty quickly after because of the sophistication of the medical care that they received. You have to imagine that there was a lot of sepsis. In the diaries that are left behind, there's very vivid descriptions of people walking hobbled and disfigured that were casualties of the war, civilian and soldiers. Mm-hmm. And you can assume that all of those numbers are low. Governments tend to keep those numbers on the low side and not attribute as many deaths as probably should be attributed to events like that.
And so people who have had traumatic injuries or illnesses are probably less likely to be able to fend off any new thing coming our way. And I think that's where you're going next.
There was a big one.
Yeah,
and
let's
that biggie,
go.
It's bubonic plague time.
Okay. I mean, it's been over 2 years that we've been together, and this is the first time we've really hit into the plague. So let's go.
It is. And, you know, it should be noted that the plague came in waves. Mm-hmm. This wasn't the first wave nor the last, but it was the most severe of the waves.
Okay.
It did end up becoming more endemic after this. And it should also be noted that bubonic plague is just one of three types of plague.
Okay. I was going to ask.
There's also pneumonic plague.
Okay.
Those are the two that people are most familiar with. The third is septic plague or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
It's the most severe. It's also the most rare.
Okay.
This particular wave was bubonic for the most part. Uh-huh. And for those of you not familiar, the symptoms of the bubonic plague include extremely high fever, delirium, painful swellings of the lymph nodes, because whereas pneumonic plague manifests itself in the lungs, this manifests itself throughout the lymph. Mm-hmm. So you're looking in the neck, armpits, groin, and it got its name Black Death because of the black bubbles.
Bubbles, yes. The kind of like giant blisters almost or growths.
Yes, yes. And so it was people were very visibly affected. Vomiting, intense muscle cramps, coughing up blood. Plague usually resulted in death. And it was normally within a week of the first symptoms. So it was a fast onset.
Woo.
The tricky thing, though, was, we know this from having lived through the COVID-19 pandemic, the first few days were without symptom. Therefore, it carried easily because you were asymptomatic, which is when things like this really start to multiply quickly. Treatments and prevention at the time did nothing to help. Sometimes patients were bled with leeches, similar to when we discussed cholera. bad air was thought to be the problem. Miasmas, those good old miasmas.
So you're just kind of having to ride it out, and some people will maybe survive the, you know, all of the fevers and all that and come through. And
some.
Yeah.
Death rate was pretty high, even more so than cholera. Yeah. It'd be interesting to look at the comparison. My gut feeling is that you were more likely to survive cholera than bubonic plague. Mm-hmm. But there were some who did. People tried to clean impure air that they, you know, were wondering because the smells, again, not that there was germs in the air, but that the odors in the air. So they would try to smoke off the bad air. So you've got all this pollution already, and you have people smoking out, you know,
those
purposely.
Bubbles are probably stinky too. Oh. I mean, I would think that would just add another layer.
Yes, because it's rotting.
Right.
I mean, you're kind of rotting from the inside. Mm. They would also walk around sniffing sponges soaked in vinegar.
Mm.
So you have the vinegar thrown in on that. The Royal Museums of Greenwich has some great information that's super easy to digest about the plague. But basically, you know, I learned there that plague had terrorized Europe for centuries. It was not new. But in 1665, it just strikes with epic proportions. Thousands killed. The Great Plague of 1665, you see various official totals listed.
Sure, I'm sure record keeping is challenging.
Challenging. According to the Royal Museums of Greenwich, which is one of the places that has expertise, they say the official number killed in just those few months was 68,595 people. But they say the true figure is probably nearer to 100,000 people, which would have been 1/5 of the city's population.
Oh my gosh.
So you think about all the people who had died throughout those civil wars, throughout the wars with the Dutch, and now 1/5 of your population from the bubonic plague.
Wow.
It did not arrive suddenly in London in 1665. For about a year before that, reports of cases were pretty much all the scuttle, you know, around town. The wealthy began to increasingly avoid the city and to take off so that they could better survive an outbreak. But for the poor, that wasn't an option. So who was left behind were those that were living in the cramped and filthy conditions, which really welcomed it was great conditions for it to proliferate, essentially. As plague is discovered, any house where plague was identified had to be shut up for 40 days with the family inside, and the doors were marked with crosses so that everybody knew this was a plague house, and they were guarded by watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
However, people then had a fear of being locked in unnecessarily, so it meant that people underreported or kept their things quiet. Does this sound familiar?
Yes, indeed.
Again, I go back to the top of the episode. History repeats. It's that human nature.
Human nature.
It just, there's that commonality. In an illustration of how plague just didn't hit everyone the same, let's take a little peek at Samuel Pepys' diary. Because he talks about it. And peep into the Pepys. As we said, he was an upper middle class white man. And it shows you that this disease was not equitable in who it attacked. Because as he says in 1665, during his annual summary on the 31st of December, which he gives us every year of the decade, he says it was the best of his life. Quote, I have never so merrily, besides that I never got so much, as I have done during this plague time. He had prospered personally, financially.
You know, that was my first thought. It's like, I bet fortunes are going to be made because of everything being upended. I bet family lines are going to be upset I just see like businesses, if some of the family dies off, someone else who wasn't likely to rise up might be able to step in.
Oh,
it's interesting.
Oh, beyond. And, you know, obviously he wasn't living in cramped housing. He didn't routinely mix with the poor. He wasn't required to keep his family in London in the event of a crisis. He stuck around a little while longer than his wife. He sent his wife off, but then he did follow when it got to be really bad. At the same time, even though Pepys, based on his December summary, was kind of in la-la land, even he could see that it was getting really bad when it was in the heat of it. On the 16th of August of that year, he wrote, "But Lord, how sad a sight it is to see the streets empty of people and very few upon the change, the exchange. Jealous of every door that one sees shut up, lest it should be the plague, and about us two shops and three, if not more, generally shut up." So he's, as he goes through, the streets are empty. And we talked at the top of the episode about the crowdedness of the streets, yeah, and people jostling.
Yeah.
Now they're eerily empty. With
Do
these...
you remember that when in March of 2020, yes, just walking around the streets and there's like, in busy shopping areas or whatnot, there's no cars, nobody's oh gosh, that's just bringing back memories.
Very, as I read, it was the same thing, which was striking the commonalities into my mind. And in particular, I was thinking back, you know, we have mentioned that we live in a town that centers around a university. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the shutdown happened in March of 2020. And there's a lot of events that happen in a university town. And we have, you know, the spring graduation. And there's, mm-hmm, another very large event that happens here where a lot of people come into town. And I remember on both of those weekends walking around. And that's normally a weekend when those of us who aren't undergraduates, basically, or aren't involved in the ceremonies directly as a participant, where you kind of bemoan the crowds and everything.
Yeah,
but boy, I kept a diary, actually, of walking around on those weekends with just, and took some pictures because it was so surreal.
Yeah.
But my mind went there as well. So yeah, Pepys wanders around and that freaks him out. And we find from his diary that he wasn't above subscribing to the common methods of protection against the plague. One of those was he chewed tobacco as protection, saying, "I was forced to buy some roll tobacco to smell and chaw," which took away the apprehension. There was a belief amongst many that that was a good way to ward off the plague, to chew tobacco. Okay. He also had great concern, as we talked about, that fashion was popular and wigs were popular, that many upper class and upper middle class men might have the horror of wearing hair from corpses as a raw material. And could they catch plague, right, from the hair of corpses in these,
yeah,
in these wigs? It just continues to get more surreal. Charles II and his court, they leave in July, first for Hampton Court, and then they go to Oxford.
Okay.
Parliament is postponed.
Gosh, I'm closes. Just thinking about this plague traveling with them too, the potentially, you know.
And it did travel to Oxford. God. And that was, Oxford had been somewhat untouched, and people fleeing to Oxford brought the plague to Oxford. So yeah, all the court cases were moved from Westminster to Oxford. So as everything's moving, so is the plague. The Lord Mayor and the aldermen, they remained to enforce the king's orders to try and stop the spread of the disease. So they were there with the poorest people who remained in London and with the rats and those people who had the plague. Now, I do want to note, there's some very recent research that thinks that perhaps rats are not to blame for the plague.
I've seen some headlines about.
I want to put this disclaimer out there because, listeners, I know that there's some of you who I'm sure have been privy to this, and it's out there. There, it's very fascinating. It's complicated. It's very sciencey, but it has to do with, they think it's certain conditions, and it has to do with your climate and your soil, and they're basing that over on where plague still exists today, and it's in pockets in Asia and Africa and in California. So that is where plague is still mostly found. The Western United States in general, but particularly in California.
Yeah.
And it has to do with soil composition and being places that are harbors for it, uh-huh, within the soil is part of the theory.
Do you know, a couple of years ago, it was the year of the rat, the Lunar New Year.
Yes.
And my students were, we did an inquiry about like why rats get a bad rep and do they deserve it? And we read some things about archaeological digs where they find that like the rat corpses are like just the placement of them under the ground where people are, like that was one of the pieces of evidence, is like the rats should have been, you know, at this level, but instead you had humans. That I don't, again, know the science or remember it to that detail, but there were some archaeological dig evidence too.
Yes, and they're still in the early stages of this. I mean, when you research this, rats are still widely blamed. And the fleas on rats and you know, might have been part of the answer, but people are really questioning that now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, then people made no connection to soil or rats or anything. They had no idea where it was coming from. We'll get to that a little more later. But these people who are left behind, their world gets even more surreal with watchmen who are keeping guard and marching up and down the streets. Parish officials are trying to provide food and get food to people who can't leave their homes, while searchers are simply looking for dead bodies at night. They're dragging them to pits for burial.
Just thinking about the delivery of food and water and necessities.
Well, and acquiring food necessities was getting difficult because trade with London and all their plague towns was stopped.
And you're thinking that the families that are afflicted, that are, you know, under quarantine, they're still throwing their chamber pots out the window, absolutely. I assume.
Oh, yes. There was no other place to go with it. So I would assume so. And I don't think there was that connection with disease in human waste. You know, the smells, but I don't even think that there was that connection.
Right.
That was being made. Trade continued to get even more difficult. Scotland closed its border with England, similar again to the pandemic we lived through with borders closing and the, you know, supply chains. You know, the supply chains weren't as long or as big as they are today, but mm-hmm. the supply chains are all stopping. This also meant that so many people lost their jobs.
Yes.
From servants to shoemakers to people who worked on the River Thames to, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's also, you've lost a fifth of the population are consumers.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
So, you know, the peak of the pandemic was the week of the of September, the 19th through the 26th of September, 1665.
Wow.
Happens to be when we're recording.
We are recording and airing.
During that peak, yes. Wow. The London mortality bills recorded 7,165 deaths in that 1 week from the plague. London appeared just deserted during the day. And you have to remember, this is pushing towards being the most populous city in the world at this time. Grass. It was so unpopular that grass was growing on the streets of Whitehall.
Wow.
You know,
just no one treading on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping of dogs and cats and other domestic animals became banned, and there would be dog catchers going through. Over 4,000 dogs were destroyed.
Wow.
Because there was a concern that they were spreading it. Boats were not on the Thames. The Thames was empty. The Navy was keeping its ships away from London. So night after night, porters are taking piles of corpses for burial, filling the pits with the dead. And then added to that were rumors of the survivors who are so desperate with grief, throwing themselves into these plague pits themselves. So... again, I want to go back to what we were talking about of just coming out of all those wars. The wars, the civil wars, the war with the Dutch. You go into the 60s with the war with the Dutch, and now you've got this on top of everything else. And I hate to pile on here, Mares, but plague wasn't the only disease in town. Typhus, TB... sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and definitely smallpox reared their ugly heads. In fact, in walking down the streets, in addition to all the wounded from the wars, you would see countless people who had deeply scarred skin from smallpox. That was an everyday occurrence. And that was a constant visual reminder of the destruction that that disease brought upon people. So, yeah, it, as I said earlier, plague has actually not been eradicated. We don't think about it much. The reason we don't think about it much, and this is so sad to think about when you hear about the destruction, is it's so easily treatable with modern antibiotics. There have been cases, even in the past decade, I know in the United States, of people with it. But if you treat it, you take antibiotics, and that's basically it.
Isn't that wild?
There's no scarring. There's no lasting effects, things like that. So it's just heartbreaking when you hear those numbers and you hear the absolute shutdown of society for something that was that easy.
Right.
To cure. I mean, much easier to cure than, I mean, smallpox. Ooh,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
So, yeah. Can you handle more?
Let me take another sip.
Take a sip. Because after all of that war, after all of that death from fighting and disease in 1665, we're now moving into the year 1666, a year that was feared by many. If things weren't bad enough, 1666 was a pretty ominous date for Christians.
Okay.
It was a millennium since Christ had appeared on earth, and the mysterious number of the beast.
Oh, it was already around back then.
Yes.
Oh, wow. How interesting.
It was prophesied in the final book of the Bible, Revelation. So many people saw the coming year as an apocalyptic omen. Coming as it did amongst the chaos and death and destruction, you can see why the panic elevated.
Sure.
This starts spawning
people
thousands.
Must just be looking for signs, right?
Oh, they are.
You have to be.
They
know, especially without medical knowledge. And
absolutely. Well, and it spawned thousands of pamphlets and speculations. John Evelyn read these and commented on them. He, being a natural philosopher and being a scientist, he read them with a mixture of fascination, skepticism, and consternation. He said, quote, "This was to be a year of wonders, of strange revelations in the world." So at the same time, the Tinfoil Hat Brigade always likes to join in on these things. There was an anonymous writer who went by the alias Friend to the Truth. These people always claim things like truth and liberty.
Sounds like it could be today. Friend to the Truth.
Doesn't it? And he produced a complex, I'm saying he, I don't know the gender, but we're going to assume if it's somebody that has access to publishing pamphlets that it's a male. So I'm going to use the pronoun he. Produced a complex calculation and explanation as to why the, in modern English, edge of Christendom would hatch its devilish beast in 1666. He was convinced that in just 6 years' time, God's wrath would be unleashed upon the earth in order to destroy this ghostly creature, ghastly creature that was unleashed. So around this idea, amidst everything else, you've got apocalyptic and mystical cults that are flourishing as pamphlets and buboes spread. And so does all of this going on at once. Scientific development, though, is also kind of starting to go ahead at this time. And as we saw in the Victorian era, really goes ahead. But a lot of this, at that this time in 1666, scientists are motivated by the desire to learn so that they can be a part of this divine closure of the world, if that makes sense. They're almost wanting to speed it along.
Sure.
And that's their purpose.
Yeah.
So
rip the Band-Aid off, right?
Absolutely. There's another group that develops called the Fifth Monarchy of Men, who dreamed that this was the end of humanity. And there's another diary by a man that isn't quite as famous, at least he wasn't to me, as Samuel Pepys and John Evelyn, whose name is Samuel Hartlib. And he pledged himself to this secret fraternity of like-minded men who together aimed to reconcile all warring Protestant factions, to start a utopian scientific community on a Baltic island. They wanted to form this commonwealth of bees, worker bees, that would model a heavenly city that they felt mimicked a city in the book of Revelation.
Wow.
And they were convinced that this would be bring heaven on earth. So these cult fringe groups, like these men, relished the prospect of violence and revolution to bring about the millennium of God's kingdom. Hmm. Just like today, mm-hmm. you hear people saying that we're in end times mm-hmm. and, you know, these sorts of things. So just like today, you had tinfoil hat people, you had these scientists, and they're flourishing against these crises of society and government around them. They're profiting on it. They're relishing it. They're flourishing in it. So as we know, doomsday predictions also run parallel to chaos. So, you know, can you really blame them?
Right.
For buying into this?
No, not at all. No.
It really must have seemed like those four horsemen were getting super close on the 2nd of September, 1666, because that was the moment London began to burn. Oh, God. We're not done, Mares. Okay, so let's go back with the total. Mm-hmm. We've got war. Mm-hmm. We've got disease. We've got tinfoil hat end of times predictors predicting doom. We've got a city that had to empty out. We've got walking wounded. Well, now we have a fire, and it's okay. The biggest one in the history of the city. This fire was the perfect storm. London was no stranger to fires at this time. They were a rather common occurrence. As we talked about before, houses and businesses were built very close to one another. Wood and thatching was the common building mode, which acts as tinder, essentially, in a fire. Like we talked about with the jetties that stick out, everything's close together. It's hard. You know, you've got this dome almost over the street. Everything's touching. So when fires start, they ravage quickly, and control is going to be an issue. At the same time, firefighting techniques were extremely basic, and there really wasn't any knowledge on how to fight fires, nor were there organized fire brigades like we have today.
Right.
So to top all that off, it had also been an extremely long, dry summer. So just before the fire, there'd been a windstorm with winds blowing from the east. As some might already know, the origin of the fire was on Sunday, 2nd of September, 1666, around 1 a.m., when a fire started in Thomas Farriner's, who happened to be the king's baker, in his bakery in Pudding Lane.
Pudding Lane, so east.
East.
North of the river.
Yes, east, but east. Yes, yes. So the fire starts, and we learn in Pepys's diary, he says, Jane, that's his servant, called us up, he and his wife, at about 3 a.m. to tell us of a great fire that she saw in the city. So I rose and slipped on my nightgown and went to her window. But being used to such fires as followed, I thought it far off, and so went back to bed again and to sleep.
Human nature again.
It was, you know, the Lord Mayor, Thomas Bloodworth, did the same thing. He didn't think it looked very serious, so he went back to bed. That's going to come back to bite him. Those aforementioned winds that had come meant that this fire spread quickly, and the buildings just started to go like tinder, ravaging up and down the roads. As people started to realize what was happening at this point, it spun out of control in multiple directions. The fire reaches its peak midday on the 4th of September, 1666. At that point, it had spread from Temple in the west to near the Tower of London in the east, according to Pepys. Pepys says, I made myself ready presently and walked to the tower, and there got up upon one of the high places, Sir J. Robinson's little son going up with me, and there did I see the houses at that end of the bridge all on fire, and an infinite great fire on this and the other side of the bridge.
And a London connection for that is the tower that he was in was the All Hallows by the Tower Church. And if you go there today, it's still there. There's a crypt museum underneath it. And so it's and it's very interesting to see all the connections, the Peeps connections. But they tell you that when you're there. They're this is where Peeps watched the London burn.
Oh, can you send that link to me for the show notes? Because I would like to see that. And I'm sure our listeners would enjoy it as well. So you've got Peeps right where you're talking about, where you've stood watching London burn. And those that are in charge, the Lord Mayor, his aldermen, as this is happening, they are almost paralyzed, not knowing what to do. And that's because they don't want to ruffle feathers, especially of the wealthy, because the answer to stopping this at this point, given their knowledge, is to start pulling down houses ahead of the fire to stop it from spreading.
Okay.
As they see it spreading, to see where it's going to go next and to just start.
Modern firefighting techniques. I mean, like, trying to problem solve it.
Yes. Mm. So finally, in the evening of the 4th of September, because it's getting so bad, gunpowder is used to go blow up houses all throughout London. It successfully stopped the fire from around the Tower of London and Cripplegate. And at that same time, nature starts to cooperate a little bit more and the winds die down and actually shift. So it stops the spread. It was also stopped at a Fetter Lane corner on the other end, at Pie Corner, Holborn Bridge, and Temple. Wow. But hot spots continued for a couple days after that. So again, I want to paint another picture here, Maris. Yeah. We've got disease, we've got war. Now gunpowder ahead of this fire is blowing up. I mean, this is a surreal nightmare.
Yes. The word trauma comes to mind, and it's maybe not even a big enough word because it's just an ongoing daily life kind of.
You're never out of it.
Right.
And that's where I said, you know, there are commonalities, and we're going to come back to some of those commonalities, but there's also things that are different. I don't know anywhere in the world where any of this would be possible, one thing after another today at this scale.
Right.
You know, you think of a fire like that burning out of control, you'd have other nations coming in, you know.
Yes.
But
on top of the disease and everything and the other losses, I'm thinking of the Blitz, of course, and the, you know, everybody doing their part and all that kind of thing. But
go back to my quote at the beginning.
Yeah, right.
That's how deeply etched
attitude
is
right
into London. And it really showed in the aftermath of the fire.
Okay.
And we're going to get to that here right now. Before, just for some numbers for the damage it did, 436 acres of London were destroyed. That was about a third of the city at the time, just gone. That included 13,200 houses and about 87 churches, and that included St. Paul's. Mm-hmm. Of course, with all that destruction, opportunists swarm, you had then looters beginning to prey on the ruins and shysters who were looking to price gouge those who needed help.
Yes.
Strangely, the fire really, there were deaths and the number varies. Some people say 6, some people say 10. It doesn't seem that there was...
Like 10 people?
Yes. The loss of human life. Now, historians argue that, you know, officially there's 6 recorded deaths.
Wow.
Okay, from the Great Fire of London. But many historians say that's also because the fire was so intense it left no evidence of life and that many more perished and were unaccounted for.
Right. I remember when we did our episode, Oranges and Lemons, and we went from church to church and how many of them were like, and the church burned down during the Great Fire, and, you know, all the records with it, of course, all the baptisms, births, you know, marriages, all that stuff.
Yeah, it vanished.
Yeah.
It vanished. What was able to be counted for was that there was somewhere between 80,000 and 100,000 people homeless. So you've lost 100,000 people this year. You know, a little more than a year from disease. Now you've got 100,000 people homeless. Bloodworth, the Lord Mayor, he ended up, he's gone.
Yeah.
Public outrage. Yeah. He was gone. He was replaced by Sir William Bolton. And just to add just a little more drama,
please.
He ended up being removed from the position shortly after. The king had declared some days of fasting and people would donate what they had, especially if they were unaffected. And £12,000 was raised, which was an enormous sum of money. So when you're talking about that kicking in and collective good helping, that's what happens. But the Lord Mayor failed to account for about 1,800 of that.
Oh, you so-and-so.
So he was accused of cheating the poor, and he was forced out, dying penniless. So it's like this society just cannot escape drama.
Right.
So there's the legacy of this fire, and you touched on a few things, and I'd like to expand on that. There's a lot of myths attached to the legacy of the fire, primarily the biggest one, and historians seem to be in massive agreement on this, was that it was a silver lining that helped to end the plague. They are pretty much all in unison that there is zero truth to that.
Right, right, right. That's, I mean, it was thought to kind of like wipe clean all the remnants of the disease or whatnot, but that's untrue.
They said it was already dying out at that point. It had been the summer before. That there's just no data that would support that. There's some that argue, and I thought this was interesting. Some argue that it alone didn't forever change the skyline of London, which in my mind, I was a person who held that. But there's some say that, you know, the temporary nature and the faulty construction of the homes and buildings meant that most of those were never going to stand the test of time anyway.
Right.
And it wouldn't look that way anyhow. There's some people who argue that it inspired the formation of what would become the modern fire brigade. The Fire Brigade Museum in London supports that. But there's others who say, no, that really didn't come about till Victorian times.
Interesting.
So, you know, I think one could argue that the mass scale of sudden destruction certainly accelerated the process of the evolution of London. It changed laws right away that prohibited certain construction materials. And it gave code essentially for how buildings had to be erected. Daniel Defoe has a good quote. He says, before the fire of London, anno 1666, Defoe writes, decades later, remembering the city of his youth, the buildings looked as if they had been formed to make one general bonfire.
Oh my goodness.
And that's now gone. Legislation gets involved between 1667 and 1670. There's rebuilding acts, which basically acted on the sentiment for the need of change. Brick and mortar and stone take the place of thatching and wood within the city. Businesses and industry that required a lot of open flame, like bakeries, they were all sequestered in certain areas away from everyone else. To halt the spread of flames, the jettying upper stories were banned. Party walls were part of it, that you had to have separation of the walls between. There were four distinct classes of building types described in the legislation. And everything became organized by what it was and by its risk of fire. So we start to get that. Organization that we would see today.
Early zoning.
It was early zoning. That was exactly what it was. During this time, it was decided that there should be a building erected to serve as a permanent reminder of the Great Fire.
Yes.
And that was provided by Dr. Robert Hooke and Sir Christopher Wren. They designed the monument, which you can find at Take the Tube to Monument, and that's the monument. It was completed in 1677, and it's just 202 feet west of the spot where the fire started on Pudding Lane. So it's 202 feet tall as a result. And
Interesting.
It was Christopher Wren who also was obviously behind the design of St. Paul's.
Oh, he was the busiest man in the town after that, rebuilding all those churches.
He was. But you know, our guy, John Evelyn.
Yeah.
The jack of all trades. Yeah. He also submitted many plans and designs for both buildings and civil engineering. He had his finger in everything. He's sort of the John Mayhew.
I feel like we might have come across him in our one about ecology and the pea soup. I think that there was something about the green space design.
And it was John Evelyn. And that would make sense.
I was just going to say, I made myself a little note here. When you said he coined that term, the Year of Wonders, There is a novel called Year of Wonders.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah, it's by... Brooks is, I believe, her last name, Constance Brooks, maybe. And it's about the plague, but it's something from London goes to a village called Iam, E-Y-A-M. And this is a famous village, if you maybe read about it during COVID, the village that decided to shut themselves off and not spread the plague.
Oh, I missed this.
It might be worth a read. It is Year of Wonders, indeed, by Geraldine Brooks.
Well, you're going to have to send me that as well. I'm putting you to work for sending me some things for the show notes. I love this. This is great.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, I've had that, but I didn't know about John Evelyn. And so it's
good. It all comes together.
Yeah, right.
And the legacy of this, you know, I see a lot when we had our Victorian arc last year, so many seeds of the Victorian era are planted as a result of these events. You know, what was learned during the bubonic plague then applied to cholera as the city design changed after the fire as the Industrial Revolution moves in the Victorian era. You see what was learned and the changes of how the city spreads and grows, and it's very symbiotic with that era. You know, one of the things I questioned during our Victorian era was that really the gateway to the modern era?
Right.
Now I'm kind of questioning if maybe it was this period. Maybe it goes back a little further. I don't know. I'm not convinced yet, but I'm questioning. You know, there's so many legacies to this era. These are just a few observations of mine. I think there's some things that are a little less obvious that have a legacy even into today. I think one is a misperception. Anecdotally, I think a lot of people outside of London and the United Kingdom often perceive London as a lot younger in comparison to other European cities, maybe like Athens or Rome.
Sure.
And indeed, that's not the reality at all. And you can find ruins. You can find, going back to the Roman Empire, you know, bits of, you know, baths and walls back in Londinium days. But I think that perception is accepted as fact by so many because so much of the city, a third of it, was destroyed in the 17th century in that fire. You know, and then obviously the Industrial Revolution was so central to London and changed everything the same. So it gives it maybe a newer feeling compared to other Western European cities. You know, I don't know. Another less obvious part of the legacy this entire period, in my opinion, is it's something, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, what were the silver linings? What is this? And people are saying there were no silver linings. It was awful. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. But I do think a legacy of this is that opportunity to learn from it and grow from it. Not just a scientific point of view, like fire prevention or disease cures or conservation efforts or whatever, but the idea that as things happen today, as chaos swirls and misinformation abounds today, and natural and man-made tragedies engulf us, as they felt lately.
Yeah.
It feels odd to say that after discussing all the things they went through, but that's what it's felt like. I think as that happens, there's a tendency to romanticize the past and people talk about the good old days and, you know, there's a focus on the horror of people these days and these times we're living in.
Yeah.
But I think by revisiting historical decades like the 1660s and remembering that things were indeed not all roses in the past, but looking and recognizing the fact that society still endured, I think we can look at what did and didn't work for those who went before us from both a psychological and a sociological perspective and apply those lessons to current battles and pandemics. I mean, London's still here centuries after this decade of intense war, disease, and utter destruction, and there's a reason for that. I feel like if we learn from it and we take those lessons and make the experiences of our predecessors relevant and useful to our lives today, as far-fetched as that may sound, that's sort of a way we can honor and tribute the suffering that they went through. Because I do think there's a lot to be learned and that we can make applicable to our lives today.
Absolutely. And to manage some of the anxieties and so on that seem to plague us today.
Yeah.
When we look at the headlines. So, wow, I've learned a ton of connections that are helping me to make sense of things that I've seen and visited in London. And again, just like looking for the people who are out there, the visionaries, you know, ultimately we come back to human nature.
Yeah. The good and bad.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And there's, you know, you made me think of something else as you were talking about London today. You know, this was also the birth of insurance companies. And apparently, and this is something I haven't noticed, they say when you're in London, you need to look up, because on some of the oldest buildings, as buildings were insured, they would put these brass plaques mm-hmm. with the insurance company logo that they were insured. And insurance was compulsory.
Yeah.
And they put them up high so that people wouldn't take them and steal them and put them on theirs because they haven't paid for insurance. And they say you can look up and still see the plaques on certain buildings today.
I think we've seen that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So it was certainly the year from hell, 1666, the year of the devil notwithstanding.
Yeah.
But I, you know, you don't want to minimize the suffering of anybody in any generation, in any year. And at any given time, there's people going through intense suffering. But wow, as a collection, it was one thing after another in this particular decade. And I don't think we could do time hopping in the 60s and not touch on this decade.
Exactly.
In our travels.
Right. So what is it? Almost 600 years ago. And I'm definitely looking forward to getting back into the time capsule. But understanding that they must have felt... like we're beat, like this is it with this, we can't endure. But time, you know, London will stand.
And it did.
Yeah.
And, you know, drop us a note of what you think it would have been like to live in this time period. Go ahead and jump in your time capsule and visit us on the socials. Get a little plug in there. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Yesterday's London Times Podcast. We are definitely moving away from, I'm still going to call it Twitter. We're not going to call it the new name. There's just that it's, as we've mentioned before, it's just a flaming dumpster right now. So, but we're moving into TikTok. So you can find us on TikTok at YLT Pod. We would love it if you would give us a follow there. We've been posting a lot of different little reels and films that are fun. So you can find us there. And we also have a blog going. You can find our show notes there and our random thoughts about whatever might tickle our fancy at that time.
Can you share a picture of the bottle of what we're drinking today too?
Oh, you know I will. I'm kind of proud of my unsmuggling of the bottle, so to say.
The blog URL, yltpodblog.blogspot.com. Wow.
Is it that acre kicking in there?
I think so.
Thank you so much. We'll have the link on the show notes as well, and you can find it. But we're having a lot of fun there. You can also put in your email and subscribe. We hope we have it set up. If you have trouble, shoot us a message. But yeah, as always, we love to hear from you. We love having you as part of our community. We love hearing your thoughts, and we look forward to next time.
Who knows where we'll be? Thank you, Jen.
Thanks for listening and thinking along with us. We hope you enjoyed this segment of our journey.
Our music is from the album Astral Gate, used with permission of the artists Lucas Perny and Miroslav Kolar. Audio mixing by DJ Kensington.